especially for Indians in India, is that you have to understand that your career is your responsibility, not the company's responsibility. I get to a lot of people who come and tell me, oh, I have worked in the company for 10 years, 15 years. Company should do this for me. Company did that, or a company should give me a career path. What is my career path? It's not the company's problem, man. It's your problem. You have to define your career path, and the company has to enable you or be transparent enough and share with you how you will get to that plan. But the responsibility of your career belongs to you and nobody else.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit. This is Ankur and Nilima, your host. On today's episodes, we are delighted to have with us Anand Deshpande, founder and chairman of Persistent Systems, a global technology services company headquartered and publicly listed in India. Anand founded the company nearly three decades ago and was instrumental in growing Persistent into the tech services giant that it is now. When Anand is not busy helping growing Persistent, he's advising college kids, young entrepreneurs, and corporations, and is also involved in nonprofit activities. In today's show, we want to get Anand's perspective on company building and India Inc., the challenges and the opportunities for young entrepreneurs who are building companies in India. Hi, Anand. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Nilima and Ankur. Really pleasure to be here. It's my pleasure. I'm quite excited to chat with you today. So looking forward to it.
Awesome. So I'll kickstart the pod with one of the questions. I was listening to one of your interviews where you were referred to as an outlier. So two questions. Would you call yourself an outlier? And if so, in what ways have you deviated from norms in your life?
See, I would say early on when I started the business in 1990, the fact that I came back to India while most of my other friends stayed back in the US, which was quite an outlier situation at that time. And of course, running a small business from India, it's been tricky. It's not that many people who come into this. So in some sense, one can call me an outlier. But really, I have not been crazy in terms of the strange things I've done. I've pretty much followed a path, and I hope we can share some of that with you today.
Looking forward to it. Over the years, you've led the growth of Persistent through both good times and bad times. Tell us about your journey over the last three decades.
Interesting story. Yes, I have had a really good fortune of being part of the internet industry from the very beginning. And not only that, actually, I've been part of the Indian IT services industry in that sense, which was a very, very tiny industry when I came back to India. And over the last 30 years, I've had an amazing ringside view of this. So I consider myself super fortunate in terms of being able to be at the right place at the right time in some sense. The trick, unfortunately, is that you don't know that when you are at that point. So this is something you realize later on rather than when I was there. So regarding my going back to India, so here's the story actually what happened. So in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a very interesting article that came out in the Economic Times around the time when I'd just joined HP after my PhD from Indiana University, and I had moved to the Bay Area. There was a very nice article in the Economic Times in India, which got circulated very widely in the sock.culture.indian kind of news groups that were there at that time. This sort of pre-internet age, right? And one of that articles just talked about something called the X plus one syndrome. And the idea there was that Indians in the US end up saying that when I finish my PhD, I'll work for 1 year and then go back. Then you get married and say, oh, no, I'm going to get work for 1 year after I'm married and then go back. Then you have kids and plus one keeps going on. And that never ends for most Indians. They keep talking about going back even 10, 15 years into being in the US. And this was quite common, actually. And I could see that happening in the Bay Area. I met so many people and was there. So I had decided that I will not succumb to this particular X plus one syndrome. Either I'm going to make one decision and move back, or decide not to move back and basically buy a boat or something to say, I'm anchored here, I'm not leaving. And so I just decided that I'd take a chance of going back. And somehow things worked out in a sort of an interesting way. I got a job at HP, and it was a good job. I was working in the HP labs out there, and I never filed for my H1. So that kind of put a little bit of a finality in my 18 months of practical training visa. I just sort of completed that and move back. And while I was moving back, India was changing. I met one gentleman, Mr. N. Vittal, who was the secretary of IT. And he had come to the Bay Area around where there used to be an association called SIPA, which was the Silicon Valley Indian Professionals Association. That is a precursor to the TIE in some sense. And he spoke about how he wanted Indians to come back. And he was setting up a software technology park in Pune. And that sort of was home for me by then. And I decided to take that opportunity and take a chance of coming back to India and doing something from here.
And then you started Persistent. Tell us how the startup scene was in India back then.
So actually the starting of Persistent in the early days was kind of pretty tough part in the early days. And the reason also has to do with the context. I want to share a few stories that you might find interesting for people who don't realize what 90s was like or 89, 90 when I came back. So it's a question for you guys, since you guys grew up in India and you were in India in the early 90s. Do you know who was the Prime Minister of India in October 1990? You want to take a guess, Nilima?
Narasimha Rao.
No, actually, neither of them were the the Prime Minister at that time. The Prime Minister of India at that time was Vishwanath Pratap Singh.
Oh, yeah.
VP Singh.
VP Singh.
And he was best known for Mandal Commission. I came back to India in October 1990, mid-October, and within a week after my coming back, and within 2 weeks after I came back, the government changed. Chandrasekhar became Prime Minister. The Indian economic situation was so bad that he had to actually move a whole bunch of gold from India to London in December of 1990 because we did not have money to borrow, and we had to keep gold as collateral. And this is a true story because one of the guys who was on that plane eventually was on my board. So he corroborated with this fact that this actually happened. So it was a pretty tough time in India. To give you another context of how this whole thing was set up. So prior to software export, the other big exporting industry was the gems and jewelry and diamonds related industry. And SEEPS was the model for that. So if you've been to SEEPS, which is the Santa Cruz export promotion zone out there, get in and get out. It's like it used to be a huge, it would take like 20 minutes to get in and an hour to get out because they would scan everything and all kinds of stuff on it. So that was a model for export zones. So software, NVITEL, as Secretary DOE, said that we want to set up STPs, which is software technology parks in India. And they were following kind of that kind of a model. You have to have a bonded warehouse. You have to come in one place. So they set up these preset parks where you would do this software export business. So they set up three of these. One was set up in Pune, Bangalore, and then they wanted to do one in Gandhinagar because he was a Gujarat cadre, but then it got moved to Bhubaneswar. The interesting thing was that the entire software technology park Pune, okay, which was the first one set up in India, was 8,000 square feet total. And they gave that space to 14 companies. We were not one of them. So they gave these spaces 300 square feet, 350 square feet, 200 square feet. So this is for doing software export from India. Okay. So the total vision of what software export meant for India in 1990 was a very archaic concept, right? So they're giving you 350 square feet and saying you're doing software export from here. And I did not get that place in my first round because we had not registered a company, all kinds of stuff, different people got in. And when I came back to India in November, starting off the business, I really did not have place in the software technology park because they had already given it to 14 other companies and there was only 8,000 square feet of total space and you could not do software export from anywhere else in the city. You had to be in that park because that was the model they were following. So it was pretty tough to get that space. And I'm going to share one more story with you from the early days. So this is from 91 and this is from March 91. And what happened was that, so I did not have space in the park. And actually when I came back to India, I had two customers who were willing to give me work. So I had work with me, so to say. And we'll talk about that a little later. But so I didn't have space to get started and we couldn't do anything until we had the space to get started. So what happened was, you know, I was kind of getting to a point where I didn't see a future of how to get a space, how to get that space in that park. So I wrote a letter to Secretary DOE, which was N. Vittal, and I'll give you the sequence of what happened. So I wrote to him on a Sunday. I typed the letter and I sent it on Monday by speed post. He got it on Tuesday. And Tuesday evening, I got a call from his office. Sir, we have written a letter. What is going on here? So then the director, Software Technology Park in Pune, got a call from the secretary on Wednesday saying, why don't you come to Delhi and figure this out? So now Pune-Delhi used to have flights, 3 flights a week. Okay, it was not everyday flight. Today there are like 10, 15, 20 flights every day. 3 days a week we would have a flight from Delhi to Pune and back. So Wednesday he got called, Thursday was the flight. So he went to Delhi on Thursday. Then he had a meeting with the secretary. And the secretary told him that you have 14 companies that you have given this 8,000 square feet. Great. Of these 8,000 square feet and these 14 companies, how many are operating from there? And he said, none, zero. At this moment, nobody is operating from there. Then he says, all right, why don't you do this? Give him your office space. He's kind of being a best. So give him your office space. And you keep moving till the last one gets occupied. And that's how it happened. And then he called me back on Thursday evenings. And this is what I've been told to do. Why don't you come Friday and collect the keys? So I got the keys on Friday. And then Sunday was Gudi Padwa. Gudi Padwa is Chaitra ka first day, which is one of very important in the Marathi context. So we said, hey, that's a good thing. Good things happen on a good day. So on Sunday, which is 17th of March, this is 91, almost 30 years back, we did a Satyanarayan Puja and got the office started. So that was March 91. And from then on, you know, Gudi Padwa has had an important significance for us because we've seen good things happen and we kind of forced them to happen on Gudi Padwa. So that's what's been the interesting story. So the early days was kind of very difficult in many different ways. There are lots of such stories, telephone connections, the time it took to send files, the speed of internet at that point, bank loans. It was very, very tricky.
Can you tell us which companies were there, those 13 companies? I can't even remember which other software companies at that time were there.
No, so I can name them, but I think it's best not to broadcast that per se. But so Thermax had a software division. They had a space there. There was a company called DSRF, which was a company that did not does not exist anymore. There were a lot of small companies who had space there.
Yeah, this does bring up one point though. Starting a software company in India has reasonably become easier now. But
oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's much, much easier to start here in US.
No, absolutely. We should talk about that. And life has become so much easier. There are lots of stories from those times because the industry at that time, the whole concept of what software is and how can you export software without sending anything and how can you do it over the internet was a very alien concept. For example, when we started out the business, right, I applied to Bank of India for a bank loan. And the loan that I had applied for was about 6 lakh rupees. And the branch manager told me that, oh, under normal conditions, you know, I can always pass 6 lakh rupees and it's not a big amount per se. But since this is software, it is priority sector and it has to go to HQ, which is Bombay. I spent 7 months trying to get that loan and I needed that money. I didn't have that kind of money. Okay. So I couldn't have done this without the loan. And it was a very small amount if you think about it, right? 6 lakh rupees. But I didn't have that money. Money at that time was not that easy to come by, kind of with fairly meager resources in that sense, though we were okay off, meaning we were not poor, but people were not counting lakhs at that time. So that was the early days. So comment I want to make, which I have learned and observed, is that businesses typically don't grow in a straight line. You'll see that businesses go through these S-curves. So you do a few things. Early days are sort of the lower end of the S and you kind of have to struggle a bit to get that point. Once you get a little bit of momentum, then you'll see growth coming in for a period of time, which is relatively predictable, or you can see that happening. But if you want to continue further, even after doing whatever you have done in that S, growth, you tend to flatten out and then you have to find your next S and the next one and the next one. So that's how businesses grow. So the first S curve of our business, as I was alluding to, was these early days. So it was infrastructure was the biggest challenge and people did not believe that India and outsourcing can be done and software can be built. My background was mainly in the database, query processing, query internals type stuff. That is where my PhD was. And I started to tap on to mainly my database friends and people who were in the database companies as CTOs. And there were lots of database companies at that time. This was mostly object databases were starting to happen, and that was the new stuff. And I spent a lot of time calling on them and got some business, and it's small business, so we were quite okay. The turning point in our business came in from a project that we did for Microsoft, actually. So this was in 92. So it's a long time back, and we were one of the early ones that Microsoft may have outsourced at that point. And this project was, what we did for them was we were, this was pre-NT. So NT, Microsoft Windows NT had not launched at that point. And they had Windows thing, and there was a Fortran compiler that they wanted to ship, and they needed graphics libraries to migrate from 16-bit to 32-bit. This is DOS extender. This is a kind of a different world, actually. People who haven't seen it should not get into this. There's 640K memory and all kinds of issues. Anyway, so we got this project from them just through serendipity. Actually, we would have not survived if I had not gotten this project. So the way it happened was we were working with a couple of customers, and they were both not doing that great. And they were both startups. Actually, one of them was a company called Data Parallel Systems. So this was a company in Indiana, and I had a colleague who had worked there. So friend from grad school who was working there. He had started that company, and we were doing a query processor for a SIMD machine. And then I had another project from a company called O2 Technologies, which is a French object database company. Sure, we were not sure how much business we would get from them and what it would look like. So I was quite desperate, and I happened to write to a friend who was, again, a grad school student with me. And she kind of said, hey, there's some project at Microsoft where if you write to this guy, maybe. So I had to call him up and convince him, and he agreed. And it was a very small project. If you look at it in the whole context of things, it was a 3-4 month project and small amounts of money. But what actually it did for me was kind of unbelievable. So one is I felt confident that we will make it. That was a big moment for us. Second, if I could get work from Microsoft, I felt that other people might be willing to do something like that. It gave me the confidence that a 10-person company in India can write to somebody at Microsoft. And if you're at the right place at the right time, again, you could get work from a big company, and you don't have to. So as small companies, you always worry that why would a big company give you work, right? And that's always a good question to ask. But, you know, sometimes if you ask, you might get, right? So that is really the key to, that was a good learning for me. And it gave me super confidence to go after companies without really thinking about how big they are versus what we are. By trying to say that if I'm doing something that is very unique and special that they need, they'll buy. Meaning it's not just size that they are looking at. And that was a huge thing for us for all through the 30 years of our existence. And this is something that I tell all small businesses, that you should not, if you have something that is very focused and clear and something that could be useful to someone, you should not hesitate in getting it to the right hands.
You've been able to lead Persistence growth over the last three decades through good time and bad times. And in this time, you know, only a fraction of the companies in S&P have survived. What do you attribute your success to over the years?
So, yeah, I think it's a good question that you ask. And it is true that it is pretty hard for small companies or companies at large to survive over an extended period of time. And it is quite tough, but, and the part of the reason that happens is that, you know, as I mentioned, companies go through these S-curves, and you hit into an S-curve where you find that at the top of the S-curve, even if you're doing the same kinds of things, you just can't grow anymore. And at that point, you tend to decline. And one of the keys to find from first S to the second to third, you have to keep moving and evolving yourselves. That includes changing your business model, changing the teams, changing how you work, the processes and your outlook. And that is pretty hard for companies, especially as they are evolving and the market is changing very rapidly. So, you know, it is a fairly hostile environment if you look at it for startups and companies. And this is true in India, but it's also true in the US. And life of companies is getting shorter and shorter.
I think the reason why we have survived, of course, and is the fact that, you know, we have evolved as we went along. We don't continue to do the same thing. And one of the biggest things is teams have evolved. We've been able to get in more people into the business. And some of those kinds of things have been really critical for the success of the business. And that is what kind of hits some of the businesses, as you would observe. And that is part of the reason why you have to keep doing different things as you go along.
I'm going back to still a little bit of early days. Getting those first 10 employees and believing in your vision to work on those two projects, How difficult was it? Because people were going to US and not coming back, as we talked about.
Yeah, so it was hard in different ways. But yes, it was always it is always difficult to bring team members into your team. And that's always a tricky one. So in my early days, what happened was I had written to there were about a half a dozen friends of mine in the US who had agreed to come back. And actually, most of them didn't come back. Two of them had come and they kind of could not take it after a year or two and they left. But the first two projects that I did have two of our guys who were with me from school and college and all that. They were there with me for the first year, but they just couldn't see the future and they kind of moved on. Yeah, then we hired locally and we sort of hired a lot of fresh graduates at that point and then basically started working with them.
Yeah. One of the questions I had was, I have worked and built products from ground up and there is about a 3 to 4 years of your own individual S-curves that you hit, where you hit a plateau, where you have to find your mojo, the thing again to start innovating. How do you do it year over year over year? Is it a function of hiring young talent so that you can keep innovating who are pushing you to then innovate? How do you not get bored of doing the same thing?
See, thankfully for me, in my 30 years, I've always had something new to do, both in terms of the challenges that the environment has provided me or the market's changing. So that has kept me going personally in some sense. And also everyone is a little different in their own style as well. But for the company to survive and thrive, you really need to bring in new blood every time and you need to think a little differently every time. And during these transitions, right, from one orbit to the second orbit, a third or whatever, you will find that you need different kinds of people at every change at that point. And that is very traumatic. That is both a good and bad in the life of a company. And those transitions are often very hard for founders as well. I just read recently an article which says people grow linearly, but companies grow exponentially. And that difference kind of makes it a problem for people.
Yeah, very well said. Speaking of the first and second orbit, I had a question for you. So we were reading one of your stories or one of your articles, and it mentioned that, you know, you've seen in your journey sort of a lot of companies, especially in India, sort of get stuck in what you call first orbit, which is about that 1500 kind of sweet spot, and then never kind of do a breakthrough.
1500 is a very big number. No, it's not that big. It's about, you know, so small businesses, right? They tend to max out when the founder maxes out, typically $10 to $12 million. And this is not in India. This is a very well-known universal phenomenon. What happens is that when you start your first orbit company, when you start a new company and you're starting out, you are driven by a product, a mission, and you do whatever the customers tell you and you keep evolving and all of that stuff. And you get to a point where, you know, that whole chaotic environment that is what makes a startup is not conducive for a structured, well-defined, process-induced company in some sense. And that transition from first orbit to the second orbit can be very traumatic for the founders. And that is really what we've been working on, as I mentioned to you earlier, was that we have this program that we run, which is for second orbit. So how do you take a business from the first orbit to the second orbit? Now, this transition is important from the founder's point of view because the first orbit is pretty much founder-driven companies. And then you get into a situation where you have to think about what does it mean to be our company and all of those kinds of things. And that's sort of that transition is not that easy for many founders. And many founders choose not to make that transition because they feel that, oh, the life in second orbit would not be the same. I personally prefer to be a first orbit company in some sense.
You also had the same transition in Persistent and you told us the story about, you know, my company to our company. How aware does the founder need to be to understand that the transition needs to happen? And is this the place where mentors come in?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that most of the times people may not realize that this is happening to them and they might find out that that transition is very hard. In my case, what happened was I still remember this would have been in the late 97 time frame. We were about 70 people company at that time. And we were doing very well, actually. Each one of us was writing code in which we were sort of bringing in a little bit of business each. And I was bringing business in and I was writing code in the evenings and pretty much all day. We were all coders. And we loved the fact that everyone was, you know, busy doing things. And we were trying to plan the future. And sort of it came down to saying that, you know, if we do more of the same kind of work, it would be so much more work for us. We wouldn't be able to handle it. And one of the guys on the team said, hey, you're thinking for yourself, right? You're saying all of this stuff is a problem. Growing the business is a problem for you, but what is it in it for me and for us here? So there's 70 of us. We want to do things as well. So why do you look at all, why are you constraining the company because of your own personal constraints, right? So that got me thinking very hard. I said, hey, that's correct. Who am I in the company to decide? Is it my company or is it our company? And that transition took me almost a year to make personally. It was very hard for me to make that transition because what happened is when we started to look at this Persistent as our company, it was very clear that I should stop writing code and do mostly sales. And this was important for the following reason that, you know, not that I was a very bad coder, but there were better, equally good coders available in the company and there weren't that many sellers in the company. And it sort of came down to my making a decision of the following that if I'm part of the company and I am at the end of it an employee of the company, I should do what is right for the company first rather than doing right for me. And that difference of saying that this is our company, so we should all do what is right for our company rather than doing something which is good for me, meaning constraining the company for my own personal whatever, was not the right thing to do. And that kind of changed my thinking quite a bit. And that really helped the company scale significantly. If I had not had that transition myself, we would not have grown quite a bit. And that transition sort of got me to the next stage of my transition in the last 18 months as well, where I sort of got to this stage of saying that, what do I want to do in the next 30 years of my I've done Persistent for 30 years. What's my next 30 years look like? And at that point, I realized that for me being this, for the company, it was not the best thing for me to remain CEO any longer. So those are all decisions where you want to decide for the company rather than for yourself. And once you decide that this is our company, the founders need to take a view that they have to do what is right for the company first rather than thinking about themselves first.
And you have this very interesting theory about visualizing the final milestone and walking back and working on your constraints around that. Are there any one or two things that you can tell our audience to keep in mind when you're visualizing that end result, and how do you walk back to your current state?
Yeah, so this is part of our second orbit workshops that I do with another friend and colleague, a gentleman called Ashok Korwar. Ashok used to be a professor at IIM from 1991 to 2001, and he has been working at Persistent as a coach and a business advisor for the last 10, 12 years. I get along well with him, and we created this workshop on which we call second orbit. So the problem is that when you are in the top of your S curve and you're trying to extrapolate growth over the next few years, you are using assumptions that are appropriate for the first S, and they may not hold when you look ahead, right? So what happens, and what I see this in many planning processes and all that, people constrain themselves because they are using assumptions and constraints that are appropriate for the first orbit. Now, when you move to the second orbit, your constraints are going to be different. Your assumptions are different. So you shouldn't want to take your old assumptions into the new assumptions. So what we tell people is, let's say you're doing a $20 million business. Then what you want to do is to define what a $200 million business might look like. Define in the sense, visualize what a $200 million business looks like. So when you look at a business that is 10x your size, you are likely to break your assumptions that you have made for your first 10x, first 20 million. So what might work for 20 is not going to work at 200. So when you say, okay, I $200 million business, what does it look like? Oh, we need to be more international, or we need to think about different kinds of markets, or can we really handle lots of small customers, or where will we find the people to do it? Can you do it all in one location? So all these questions come up. Because now you're visualizing something that is 200 million and not 20 million. Because otherwise what happens is when you do look 20 to 25, 25 to 30, you keep stretching the envelope up to a point and you have reached a point where there's so much chaos in the organization that you cannot grow it any further. So you have to look at fresh things. So that is the reason why you look at something else, 10x or something much bigger, and you visualize that. You build a model on it. It has multiple benefits. So in addition to sort of looking at what the constraints are and where are you holding, what is holding you back? One other thing that it does for the business is that everyone feels now that, oh, we need to grow and we need to be a $200 million business. So a lot of the decisions that you have to make, cultural alignment, positioning, getting the team to be thinking in one direction, sort of happens very nicely because now you are thinking, oh, we are going to be a $200 million, not a $25 million. But that attitude really helps in getting everyone to think about
being a bigger business than the one they are. And doing that at a relatively larger size is very important. And that's one of the exercises that we do quite a bit at, which we call this visualize to realize. Basically, three issues that we run into when you are from the first orbit to the second orbit. One is relating to positioning. So what happens in a small business is you're running a $20 million business. The reality is that the world only wants to buy from leaders. So how do you be a leader at $20 million business? I mean, you're not a really huge company. You're a smaller business. So the key is to define the market where you can be a leader. And the trick is to figure out if you're a $20 million business aspiring to be, let's say, 50 and 100, you want to play in a market that is no bigger than $500 million.
Yeah.
Because then at 20% market share, you still have a play. Now, this is very hard for a small company in, say, Sangli or Pune or even other these places. Say, okay, we want to do IT services. Oh, yeah, it's a $1 trillion market. We are going to get 2%. It doesn't work like that, right? So you have to basically define, okay, this is my specialization. This is where I'm going to go. So that's what we spend a lot of time helping people. So one of the biggest challenges for growth is one is positioning. The second thing is team. When you are in the first orbit, everyone, the founder gets this mentality of people working for the founder. And there is a bunch of founders, but everyone works for them. They have not hired as many peers as they need to get to the next level. So how do you get peers to join your business when it's already a running business? It's much easier to get two founders to join when you have nothing to start with. But now you're already a $20 million business. You need two other people who are going to be your peers to join your business, which is already running. It's a pretty hard thing to do. And that is one of the biggest challenges that companies have to scale.
Yeah.
And the third thing is that how do you set processes, boards, mentorships, those kinds of things. So we spend a full day trying to explain to people how to do this. And we've had good success. I've done this about 30 to 40 times. Ashok has done it much more than me. And we have touched about 500 to 600 companies in that zone. And while I don't track them actively, I do get back mails from people who come back and say that we attended this workshop and we found it to be valuable. So to that extent, yeah it's good.
Yeah, it's very fascinating. A follow-up question I had on this subject was there are, I guess, a couple paths to get to that 10x revenue, 20 to 200. Right? One is sort of double down on what you're doing, add fuel to the fire. Second one is start another fire. Right? Like in your analogy, start another S curve. So let's say one way to get to that type of revenue number is start other businesses or other product lines. How do you trade off starting and investing in something completely new, taking away resources and funding from the existing businesses that are growing at 20% year over year? How do you balance the two?
No, so that is a different question, but that is important. But what I'm referring to when you move from the first orbit to the second orbit is not just about product. It is about the team, the processes, the methodology of how you work together. How do you build teams? Who do you hire? What kind of processes do you need to have? Do you need a marketing team? Do you need a sales team? Do you need real salesmen? And do you need to put people in different offices? So what happens in the first orbit is that the scope of the team is restricted to the founder and his people he sees in his room or people who is working closely with him or who have grown with him from the very beginning. But now you want to take it to the next level and you have to change some of these things. So going back to, so this is a little different or a little broader than just saying that, you know, is it about one product, too many products? That's a different discussion. Now, the question is, should you start one, grow the fire and fuel the fire? Of course, you should fuel the fire. But to fuel that fire, you might need to make sure that while you're going to take a small fire and make it bigger, you better have the fire extinguishers and all of the other paraphernalia to ensure that if it goes out of control, you have a way to control it. When you are building your own fire in your kitchen, yeah, meaning it's okay, it's like fine. But now you're going to make a commercial one, you better have all the safety, the requirements that you need to have it. You need to have enough people to make sure that that fire has the fuel to keep burning. And so there's a lot of paraphernalia that is needed to keep that fire growing. And it can't be done by just saying, okay, I have been running this small fire. We have five people and this great fire. We are good for it. Now let's go make it a huge fire. So you will burn yourself in that fire. So so you have to plan your processes. You have to have the team. You have to have a clear understanding that even if you want the fire to be bigger, are you going to just grow this one? Are you going to create another one just a little bit away and then let the two merge or however you might want to think about it? So the challenge that companies have is not about the methodology. It's about the founder's attitude to thinking, about, you know, have I planned through this enough and do I have the right people on my team who are willing to think like this? Otherwise, everyone will say, no, it's too big a fire, I'm running away. You are left with a huge fire, you don't know what to do with it, and that's what might kill you in the process. So that is really what this is all about, is to sort of understand that when you have now reached a point where your current fire is burning fine, but it will not grow if you don't do something different.
Does this theory also apply to managing careers? I know you are advising plenty of young and mid-career professionals. And in our discussions, you had said 40s is the time when a lot of people plateau. What advice would you have for people who are just starting in their career or are in their mid to late stage careers and are aspiring for the top office?
Yes, as I said, you know, I've been now doing this 30 years. I get to meet a lot of people. And I see a lot of people mid-career, I find are dookie in that sense, right? So mid-40s is sort of the, in my opinion, the time when, till early in your career, kids and individuals believe that I can do everything. I'm going to eventually be the CEO of the company. But, you know, at the time, mid-career, they sort of realize that maybe that's not going to happen, right? And that can basically make your make people very frustrated and say, oh, no, I have worked 25 years and I don't see a clarity. So that got me thinking really hard on saying that, you know, what would it take for people to plan their career so that they know where they are and they can make a cool decision about where they need to go? And the other thing that I find is a lot of people come and say, oh, follow your passion. Yeah, it's okay for a 25-year-old to follow your passion. But if you're a 45-year-old and you have an aspiration to be a corner office and your passion is to play golf, that's not going to get you to your corner office, right? Meaning, so you have to be a little realistic about what this follow your passion business means. And it's become a fad. So, you know, so here's my theory that I tell people in terms of how they should manage their career. And it's a plan that you have to put together and you have to review it every so often. So first 10 years, I tell people in their career. So let me sort of paraphrase this in the following way. Somebody who graduates from college typically is in the early 20s. They're going to work 40 years of paid career, and then they're going to work for beyond that doing other things because typically organizations will not pay you beyond that. So that's the reality of how careers have to be managed. So first 10 years of your career, I recommend to people that they should focus on learning and networking. And the reason you want to do this in your first 10 years is because once you learn how to learn and you learn how to network, then your ability to do that the rest of your life is so much better. It's much harder to learn when you are in your mid-40s. If you haven't learned how to do networking in your first 10 years, you'll have it very difficult to start networking when you get older. Right? So you have to do some of these things early. And when you are learning, it doesn't matter exactly what you learn in these days. Today, you're going to do many different things. So if you wanted to go trek the Himalayas for 1 year when you are 25, fine, do it. It doesn't hurt you that much. You would still learn something useful and it can be applied somewhere else. So first 10 years, your focus should be mainly on learning and networking. In your second 10 years now, I suggest to people is that, you know, by the time you have completed 20 years of experience in a job, you should be able to say what you're good at. And not only should you say what you're good at, the world should say what you're good at. So when you come to me and say that, no, I have 20 years of work experience in working in this company, that company, that company, that's pretty useless, actually. You need to tell me, what has that 20 years of experience done to you? So who are you now because of your 20 years of experience? Right? So now you're at the early 40s stage. So at the time you are at the early 40s stage, you should already be an expert at something. You should be really good at something that you have done, right? So you say, I'm really good at technical stuff, marketing, whatever it is. But there is no place for people who are generally okay at many things, but not good at anything. Now, and I say this to people that when I'm hiring someone senior in the company, typically we are looking at three kinds of skills. One is tech and the sort of domain capabilities, which is our deep domain technology expertise. The second skill we are looking for is somebody who can sell. Always important. Anybody who can sell. Third skill we are looking at is someone who can project manage, keep trains running on time and all that. Now, when you're looking for someone in the mid-40s or sort of in the third stage of their career, you're not looking for someone who is a 3B. Oh, I can do some of this. I can do some of that. You want to ask a guy, all right, what is it that you are really good at? Show me at least one A in something. Right? You're in one of these things, at least you should be really great at. Should be really good salesman, or you should be really good at managing people, or you should be really good at, and not only should you say it, the world should say it. So that is part of personal branding and how do you create your own personal brand so that by the time you are at the end of your 20-year career, you already have an established personal brand and identity So you are not dependent on the fact that you have worked for so many years. Those work experience of those many years has given you some place to be, and you have a perch that you can sit on, right? So that is important to achieve by the time you completed 20 years. Now, the 20 to 30, this is the key thing, right? You're already perched at a certain place. You have to define where you want to be in your early 50s, because typically corner offices today go to people in the late 40s, early 50s. If you look at CEO announcements, and you'll find that most of the people who get CEO announcements typically are in the early 50s. You don't see too many people at 60 being CEO. That happens in the army, where you have that particular, you know, you have to be 58 before you can be a general.
Or POTUS.
Yeah, but that's a different path. Okay, this is corporate. But yeah, meaning you're right.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of define where your corner office is. So now the question is, from 40 to 50, let's say 42 to 52 or whatever, you have, in my opinion, no more than 3 steps to get to that point. And the reason is that, how does somebody pick a CEO? So if I'm trying to find somebody who is CEO at Persistent, for example, how would I hire someone? There are 3 ways it's going to happen, right? I might go find somebody who is already number 2 in the company, who's been groomed for that job. He'll take that job. So that's the first most obvious option. The second option is that someone who is already a CEO and maybe a smaller company and who sees joining Persistent as an upgrade. And the third one may be somebody who is running a business unit already and in a larger company, but his scope of his business that he runs, even though he's not CEO, is much bigger than what we run. So he'll find that, okay, fine, this is a good place to be. Now, if you want to be there at 52, at 48, you need to be 1 minus before that. And that's why you have only 3 steps to get to that point. So that's really what I tell people. So the question is, at early 40s, you better be in a situation where you have some of your own expertise, you know what your strengths are, and then you can evaluate from that point, how far are you from the corner office? And at this time, you need to readjust your corner office. Maybe you're not going to be CEO ever, because it's going to take you 10 steps to get to that point. You only have 3. So maybe you should define that my corner office is just the CTO, or my corner office is going to be the chief of marketing, or my corner office is to be CEO, but in a smaller company, or whatever it is. So, and at the end of it, you know, happiness is a function of managing expectations, right? So if you get what you expect, you are happy. So part of being there is to define, something that brings you close to where you need to be, rather than trying to have an aspiration that's completely misaligned with your, where you are in reality. So this is a good time to make that kind of discussion.
Are there like other hacks to get to that corner office? And I ask this question is that, especially people who come from India or subcontinent, you talked about the expertise phase, the second phase. Oh, only if I can learn for like few more years about this thing, I'll get to that next step. And then they learn and the technology has moved on. Okay, well, I kind of learned this other technology and this other thing. And they keep on chasing this learning thing. And then you've got these other people who continue to rise in the organization. Are there other aspects, other subtle aspects that one has to be conscious that, like, you know, self-promotion, self-marketing, being in the right good books of, you know, the CEO, the things that are obvious, but often people ignore in the quest and thirst for just constantly learning. But then there are other people right besides them who are just kind of zooming past them. Anything other stood out for you in terms of, getting...
You're right, actually. But see, the way I cover this is that in your early 10 years, first 10 years, you should learn how to network. By networking, I look at networking as a much broader thing. I think to some extent, networking is all about trying to know the right people, having the right mentors, having a way to have a network of friends and people who are, you know, who are able to, where you can discuss some of these things and you have a way to get ahead. So the networking part is very important, and you know, it's worth spending a lot of time thinking about what exactly that means. And when we do these workshops again, I spend a lot of time trying to explain to people how networking needs to be done and how it is important. And to some extent, that gives you the organizational awareness and the sort of the sounding board for you to realize where you are and where you want to be. And that sort of having the right mentors, and this is your responsibility. One of the very important things, especially for Indians in India, is that you have to understand that your career is your responsibility, not the company's responsibility. I get to a lot of people who come and tell me, oh, I have worked in the company for 10 years, 15 years. Company should do this for me. Company did that. Or company should give me a career path. What is my career path? It's not the company's problem, man. It's your problem. You have to define your career path, and the company has to enable you or be transparent enough and share with you how you will get to that plan. But the responsibility of your career belongs to you and nobody else.
Great point.
And that's something that people tend to miss out in India quite a bit, because we are used to follow the guy in front of you and just keep following him, right? So that's the idea. Everybody is going to college, this college, so I also go there. Everybody's doing engineering, I also do engineering. You know, everybody joined the first job that you got, you just go join. Everybody's quitting, so I quit. It's like, you know, we just follow the herd. So that needs to, you have to take responsibility. And that's very important. And unless you do that, you will not succeed.
One question on networking. You can do consciously, but it builds up over time. One, and there is a lot of serendipity that comes in, right? Because if you try too hard, it is very, very obvious. So any tips there on how to network well over time?
Yeah. So two things I would give people to think about. One is that a lot of networking or people you remember are those who are people who you do useless things with, in a sense, who you waste time with in a way. So here's a thought experiment I ask a lot of people to do, and you should try this out. Who are your best friends today? The people you hung out with from college and all that. It's not the topper in the class or that one particular brilliant kid who was something, you know. It's not those guys. It's those people with whom you did totally whatever. You hung out, had chai or did coffee or had parties or whatever else. So the point is that these kinds of things are things that are more likely to carry you along, is something that you should think about. The other question I ask, and these are all, you know, you can figure out for yourself, right? So who are your best friends? Why are they your best friends? When did they become your friends? Why do you remember some people, not some other people, right? So those are questions, if you ask yourselves, you will get your own answers. So this particular question I've tried asking to you. So you meet a lot of people every day. Why do you remember some people and not some other people?
Yep.
So why are some people more memorable than the others? Why do you remember some, not the other people? So that's a good enough question to ask you yourself and say, why do I remember him and why not someone else? What did he do in etch a link in my network that I can still remember? And if that's what he did, maybe I should do something similar. So those are the ideas that you should look at. And I think a lot of this has to do with, of course, if you are too loud, then people will cut you off their net. So there is a little subtlety needed in this. And it takes a while. And the network builds other networks as well. So once you know someone, they can introduce you to some other people that might go somewhere else as well. So it's a mutual network thing. And everyone likes to tell other people and introduce each other and all of those things.
Yeah, great advice. Thank you for the details on this, Anand. You know, I know you've been super generous with your time. We've got a couple questions for you still left on the pod. The big one that we had was about the startup scene in India. So obviously the startup landscape looks today really different than it did like even 5 years ago. You know, you have companies like Paytm and Baiju and Oyo and a whole bunch of unicorns now. As a matter of fact, India with 21 is ranked fourth, right behind the UK in terms of number of unicorns. Why do you think that is? What's changed over the last few years? Obviously, one is like, obviously, there's a lot of liquidity. But are you seeing some fundamental tectonic shift that's leading to so many unicorns?
Yes. So there are, let me sort of separate these out into two different markets. So one is India as a market has become a very attractive market. This was not the case 25, 30 years back. So when we started Persistent, our software, nobody would have bought in India. Nobody built database query optimizers in India. So there was a very different world at that time. Today, what has happened is that with bank accounts, with everyone, the fact that you have billions of phones and network internet connectivity and everything else that has happened, and the whole ethos of younger people in the country has made it possible that the sort of what they call the Bharat, or 750 million people in India who have recently been empowered with internet, bank accounts, and a whole bunch of other things, has really created a market that is completely underserved by international products and products that are at large available. So the top 10-15% of India would buy something that is in English and it's pretty much common. But if you look at movies, content, entertainment, food, the middle group, that 750 million, which is a very large population, that has become a very attractive market for a lot of these companies. So if you look at education, Baiju and all this, they're not just catering to the rich or the top 10-15%. They're actually going after the next 750 million people, the OYOs and all of them. So that's really created that market availability has made it possible for products that can reach a broader base now have very large following. So that has really been one thing. And see, you need role models. And if you have people who are able to do this, and you know, more and more of these things happen, more and more people follow doing them. Younger people are willing to take a chance today. And I think it's the right thing for them to do as well, as to take a chance, work with startups, work with early stage companies. And that has been helping companies. And there's a lot of buzz right now in India. Everybody from the prime minister down is talking about startups. And so it's going all over the place. So yeah, it's pretty exciting at the moment to be in India for a startup or to start a startup.
What are some of the challenges that still remain that's coming in its way to become the next Silicon Valley, be it Bangalore, Pune, or India in general? What are some of the challenges or opportunities?
So the startups are definitely happening in India, but the ecosystem, I think, is still a distance away from being what it is in the Bay Area or in the Silicon Valley. So it'll take some time before people start to see enough of people who know how to run these and how to be successful. There are lots of Me Too product models and things in the market at the moment, and the deep tech startups, there are very few in India. I think big early stage investments are not as common. The unicorns are those where the market is large, so they're going after a bigger market. Many of these sort of tech companies are still early in the game. I think it'll take a few years, though. I think we'll get to a point where more and more people would be willing to take big tech bets. And that's not quite happening yet, but I think we'll get there. See, the thing is, you know, in India, at least at this moment, there is a lot of energy amongst the young people and people who want to try different things. The breadth is definitely there, and there are a lot of people who are trying things out. The depth of doing sort of the senior tech layer of people who have invested 30 years or 20 years being expert at some technical area of, okay, 5G and some other crazy things in the corners. That community of people in India is sorely missing. So we don't have as many people who sort of my age who are deep techies at the moment, I would say. And they have not jumped into the startup world in a big way. So a lot of the guys who are doing startups are the younger ones. And they are good at some of these things. So that's sort of the difference where you look at, say, the kinds of companies that you have worked in. Those tend to be more Silicon Valley oriented because they have senior tech people who have deep understanding. And that community of people is still missing in India. And that's one of my missions as well, to try to see how to keep people remain techies or be involved in the deep technology side of things.
Ankur and I, we've worked in B2B enterprise security space now for years. And we still see that if you have to start enterprise security or any kind of enterprise business, the first set of customers or adopters are still in the US. Do you see that changing anytime soon?
Yeah, I think it is starting to change today. So the big banks in India and other people in India are starting to buy products in India. And we are deploying some pretty innovative solutions in fintech. And I think health tech will also happen in a big way. Ed tech is starting to happen. So now companies are starting to happen that have seen scale locally in India, and they'll be able to contribute. But see, the challenge in India has always been the fact that manager roles tend to pay better. People prefer to be managers first and not really deep techies. So any chance that a person gets to sort of become a manager, they kind of run away from the deep coding or whatever else that is needed. So the best people end up being managers. And I guess that is part of the problem why we don't see that many people focused on deep technology in that sense.
Last question of the pod. And we've learned so much. We know you're involved in a lot of foundations and nonprofit initiatives. There is especially one where you're helping small businesses. Can you talk a little bit about that? And what was the thought process around giving back?
Yeah, as everyone goes through this thing, and I reached my 50s, and I sort of figured that I should be thinking about what next, what do I do post-retirement, and how do I start to contribute? And then I started looking at some of the kind of work that other people have done, such as Bill Gates or, you know, Michael Dell, and all these guys have their own foundation. So I set up my own foundation. It's called Deasra Foundation. So D is for Deshpande, and ASRA are the initials of the family members. So it is deasra.in for India. And the idea was that let's pick one problem that is big enough that will last several years, 10, 15, 20 years to work on. So being where I am, I think jobs is a big issue in India. We have 25 million people at every age in India. We need to create 15 to 18 million jobs every year. And these jobs are not going to happen through large companies and governments. Most of these jobs in India are going to come from very small businesses, those who employ between 2 and 10 people, 2 and 20 people. And the corner food counters and beauty salons and the services in urban segment, that's the biggest, fastest job growing industry, or that's where jobs are happening. And we sort of came to the conclusion that if you want to do something meaningful, we need to make sure that the sort of job creators happen at scale rather than just job seekers. So how do we create job creators of this kind? And then when we studied the business models of very small sort of tailors and everything, why should every tailor have to figure out how to run their business? They're all very similar. So can we template these out? Can we create ways for every small sort of business to not have to figure out everything from scratch, but use what is already there? So we set up a bunch of things to make that happen. And that's been our focus. So our focus is to work on the really small 2 to 10 employee type businesses, those that make between, say, 5 lakhs and say 1 crore in terms of revenues. And these are the food counters, the beauty salons, the dance classes, and anybody who wants to start a business. So we have everything that a small business needs end to end, preset and predefined. We help them get bank loans. How do you get your marketing set up? How do you hire people? How do you go online? So all of those things, we have made that happen. Been doing this for about 6 years now, and we have crossed 110,000 to 120,000 businesses that have benefited or have come to our platform or picked things here and there. And we're growing quite well now. And we're starting to sort of, we are doing a new focus on women entrepreneurship right now in partnership with a bunch of people. So that's the next big thing that I'm working on this.
For our listeners' benefit, if they want to reach out, is there a website?
Yeah, so there is a website. It's called deasra.in. So www.deasra.in. And they should be able to find information about what we are trying to do and how we want to go about it. So this is one problem I'm really passionate about, in the sense that we need people in India. The startup stuff is all very sexy. It talks nice about the 1 crore, 5 crores, 1 million, 10 million, all those kinds of things. Point is, you know, everyone can be self-employed, and that's sort of where we are headed. Gig economy is going to happen and all of those kinds of things. So it's, I think, important that every small person who wants to run a photography thing or anything of that kind, they should not be struggling to do that. We need to encourage and help them to be successful. And it's a few things that they do right, they'll be doing quite well for themselves. There's enough in India happening that people at that stage can make decent amount of money from these kinds of businesses. It's just that we want to make sure that they don't fail. And that's what we have been working on. And I'm quite open to suggestions, ideas. We have about a 40 people team working full time on this. And the sky's the limit. There is no shortage of things to do in this market.
Absolutely. For the workshops that you mentioned, if there are people who want to reach out, what is the best way to get there?
Well, just write to me. I do these sort of, I don't have a very structured platform to do any of these things. I kind of usually Saturdays are what I do for these kinds of things, but happy to help whoever, you know, however it happens.
Awesome. Yeah, that just about wraps up this episode of Zero to Exit. Anand, it's been a pleasure to have you on the pod. We learned a lot in this process, and I'm sure our listeners are going to learn a lot about the startup scene, growing careers, how to live a fulfilling life. So it's been super informative. You know, you've been super generous with your time. We appreciate that and hope to have you soon on the podcast.
Hey, thanks a lot, Ankur and Nilima. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. And thanks for inviting me. I really look forward to chatting with you more in the future.
Thank you.
Awesome.